This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest in our ongoing series of AdNonTech Conversations. We have had some amazing, excellent guests over the past couple of weeks. And honestly, I could not be more thrilled to be joined by Dr. Tony Bates, who has had a pretty substantial career. It's about as substantial and high profile as it gets within our e-learning area. I think I can barely say that. When I mentioned that Tony was going to be joining us, Doug, the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed, who's the co-host of these, he just made a point. He was like, I want to make sure that I'm in on this particular conversation, just because, again, Tony, without sort of being po-faced about it, for, you know, people of me and Doug who have been in the field subsequently to the beginning of your career, your work has really provided a lot of guidance to those of us who have spent time in the e-learning space and particularly in higher education. So thanks a million for being here, and we really sincerely appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be invited.
Really glad, Tony. Thank you. So we're going to kind of take a back and forth kind of approach, just so that people aren't kind of getting too much of me or too much of Doug. The emphasis, of course, is certainly to learn more about the various initiatives and work, the significant work that you are continuing to be involved in. But I guess before even kind of stepping into that area, I kind of have this bit of a chestnut, but it's kind of an opening gambit for any of these interviews, is for, you know, folks who may be kind of looking in from outside of our distance learning or e-learning field. Who is Tony, and what motivates you as an educator, sir?
Well, I guess I've always been a kind of I've been an educational researcher. That's how I started my career. I ended up my first contract having come to an end. I was looking for a job, and the British Open University was starting up in 1969, and they wanted a researcher to do research into distance education at the time. And as you're probably aware, the Open University was in partnership with the BBC, who made television and radio programs to go with. And since 20% of the Open University's budget was going to the BBC, they felt they ought to have an evaluation of the programs. And that was my job, basically, was to evaluate the programs. So I set up a Center for Audiovisual Media Research at the Open University, hired a few excellent people, and we spent basically 20 years looking at not only broadcasting, but as all the new technologies came in, like audio cassettes and video cassettes, video discs, computer-assisted learning, and so on, we just kept on evaluating it. Then in 1989, I felt that I'd done all I could at the Open University, and I was looking for, I think I was looking for more of a management role then. So I emigrated to Canada to the Open Learning Agency, and I spent 5 years there, and then moved to University of British Columbia, where I was basically director of distance education and technology in continuing studies. And again, I built up quite a big research group there as well. And we introduced the first online programs at UBC. And I guess, you know, that's then I retired from UBC, mandatory retirement, and set up my consultancy company and worked for the last 20 years as a consultant in e-learning, working across the world.
Wow. There are so many aspects to that, and I know that Doug has some awesome, you know, kind of questions. What were you thinking about, Doug, in terms of, you know, checking in about some of this?
My career really started with online learning, and I first jumped into iPods in education and iPads later. So that's after you were already in your consultancy roles. But what I would really like to know, because we are more personal than just ed tech, is I have some favorite stories from some of my research or publications. Do you have any favorite stories where it's like, oh, we couldn't believe that happened, or wasn't it great that this happened? Do you have something like that you could share with us from any of your research?
I would, not from my research, I would say that my favorite story is how I discovered the internet. I was visiting Vancouver. I was still based in England. And a colleague, David Kaufman, from Simon Fraser University, said, come down to my basement. I've got something to show you. And I didn't know him very well. So I went down rather cautiously. And he had a telephone hooked up to a modem and a computer. And he says, look at this. And it was basically, I guess, I can't remember what it was, but it was an emailing list. And he clicked on one, and you just clicked on it. And if anybody was live, they would respond. So we had this little chat. This is about 10 o'clock at night. And this person was from New York. And so we were having this chat, and we were asking, you know, what's the weather like and so on. And then I said, well, wait a minute, it must be 1 o'clock in the morning. Ask him how old he is. And he was 12 years old. And that was my introduction to the internet. And it was a very important moment for me, because up to that point, computer-assisted learning had been pretty behaviorist, you know, give a piece of content and test it, and then give automated answers to the multiple choice tests and so on. And I saw this really as a better way to use computing, to allow people to communicate with each other rather than communicating with a machine via the internet, via a computer, so they could integrate that with their other studies. So that was 1986.
Wow. I was 8 years old in 1986.
Mind you, electricity had been invented.
I remember, you know, myself, when my parents split up, but I mean, respectively, you know, at one point my mom got the, you know, 1988 or 1999, the first laptop in our home. And I remember a box like a Tandy, you know, sort of machine at my dad's place. And I have some very clear memories of, you know, even apart from the internet, but just as somebody who was interested in communicating through stories and fiction, that was just something that really resonated with me, that when I look back on my present trajectory or whatnot, that this has, you know, come into be such a significant piece of, I don't know, personal history that kind of dovetails with a shift in the culture, right, through the information age. Doug and I have made so many just various analogies about, you know, wouldn't it be cool to have like educational vinyl or, you know, the physical mixtapes or some of these anachronistic kind of formats, these also ran kind of formats. So to have you sort of speaking to, you know, the time when you were actually involved in the broadcasting endeavor and whatnot. One question, Tony, sorry, is that when you've joined up with the Open Learning Agency, was that's what turned into Thompson Rivers, is it not?
Well, what happened there was that the government closed it down. The incoming Conservative government, I'll make that very clear, turned it down, closed it down. But they were embarrassed to find they had about 12,000 students still registered with the Open University, so they had to find a home for them. So they kind of dumped them on Thompson Rivers, who at that time didn't really want them, because they just moved from being a community college to an on-campus university, and this stuff didn't fit with what they saw as their mainstream. But they've managed to integrate it over the last 15, 20 years, but it wasn't a happy marriage.
Doug and I have both spent significant time, formative time, I guess is probably kind of a not unfair way of putting it. And that's actually how we first became, you know, colleagues and friends, and how this the impetus for this podcast developed was essentially that former TRU colleagues, no longer at TRU, sort of felt compelled to document our practice and work and have a little bit of fun vis-a-vis a podcasting format. That's a pretty fair estimation of it, is it not, Doug?
It is. It is. I enjoy the friends that I used to work with, and now we get together and tell stories and all the old times and all that silliness. So, yeah, I really enjoy that.
Well, awesome. So I guess one of the questions that Doug has kind of placed into the document that's in front of us that's kind of landing with me is that I wonder, you know, given your sort of significant high level overview of the sector, you know, what would you be looking for in somebody who's entering the field at this juncture? You know, if somebody's kind of just coming into it from whether a teacher training program or what have you, I guess, you know, Doug has referenced kind of, you know, being aware of online learning at the beginning of his career. I guess, given the current kerfuffle about generative artificial intelligence, you know, the so-called ed tech hype a bit around it, and given how much you're involved with your work in Contact North about some of these topics, what kind of advice would you be interested in sharing with somebody who's kind of entering the field just currently, sir?
Well, I don't envy them, to be honest. I think it's a real challenge. I think three things are happening that's making the life of a university instructor particularly difficult. The first is, as you mentioned, the impact of artificial intelligence. Not so much because at the current time it's really going to put people out of work, but because it's going to change the nature of work in a university, of teaching in a university. Or if it doesn't, universities are in trouble, because students can get most of the kind of content acquisition now just by going online and downloading it, and it'll all be organized and sorted for them just as well as any professor can do. So professors are going to have to focus on the second big challenge, and that is the move to what's called future skills. And these are things like critical thinking, independent learning, etc. And there is increasing pressure from governments, employers, and really from students, or should be from students, because it's going to affect the students more than anybody. The ability to have what I call transversal skills, skills that work across a range of occupations, a range of disciplines, like critical thinking and so on. Now, the issue is the responsibility of a history professor or a welder who's teaching welding, you know. On the other hand, if the students don't leave with those skills, they're going to find it really hard in the workplace or in life generally. So, you know, digital literacy is another big area. Just knowing how to survive, I could give you 100 stories of how my life daily is now messed around with by the big tech companies changing their software, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you have to be a highly skilled person now just to live, never mind to study or work. So there's that pressure as well. And then there's the third pressure that governments are not giving any extra money to universities these days. And they're having to cope with larger classes, less support, etc. Now, you can probably change the third one. The government really needs to look at countries like Singapore that have a national skills strategy that comes from the government to make sure that students are lifelong learners and learning all their lives, so they can keep updating their skills or changing their skills as the external environment demands. I won't just say the workforce demands, because it's other areas besides the workforce. It's social life, etc. So this makes it a real challenge. How are we going to deal with this problem of shifting the way we teach in universities to accommodate those three pressures without making it impossible for an individual instructor to manage? And I'm hearing more and more, especially people in the 50 to 60 age group in university, saying, this, I'm out of here. You know, this is not what I signed up for. And this is a really big issue now. And I don't think we have a solution for it, because the preparation that we have for instructors is so archaic and out of date that you, if you wrote it in a Monty Python sketch, it still wouldn't be, you know, unacceptable. Because, you know, the idea of a six-year PhD preparing you for modern teaching in a university, it is ridiculous. You know, it's a good preparation for research. So either teaching will get forced more and more to something that's just done on the side or handed over entirely to artificial intelligence. But I think that will be a really bad move. I think we need instructors. We need instructors' passion for a subject to infuse the students and so on. But I think our institutions and our governments have some major rethinking to do if they're going to produce a workforce that's suitable for the 21st century, because our system isn't set up to do that at the moment.
I love everything you just said. We've spent 60 odd episodes saying that exact thing over and over again, because I was a tenured prof at one point, and nobody cared about my teaching, but that was the most important part for me. It was, okay, how many publications did you pump out, right? What committees were you on? Nobody cared about the teaching. And I was in a faculty of education and pulling my hair out, saying, no, this is the important bit. So to hear that come from you, it really makes me feel good. It's like, I might be way out in left field, but at least somebody's out there with me. So that's awfully nice. And I know Matt is too, so.
Well, and I guess further just to those remarks, I would say, you know, I'm quite surprised, you know, at how much we've already just covered here in about 15 or 17 minutes. I do wonder, though, Tony, whether some of this impetus to sort of make practice through technology as an educational endeavor more accessible, is that something that sort of helps motivate the updates that are currently happening on teaching in a digital age? Is that somehow related to the data which you sort of seek as somebody who's involved? I don't know if you had a chance, Tony, to check it out, but I spoke with Cole Johnson of the Canadian Distance Learning Research Association just the previous episode ago, and she had nothing but great things to say about you, particularly some of the guidance and mentorship that you have, you know, shown throughout our sector, especially, you know, and particularly vis-a-vis the post-secondary survey. So I just wonder if either of those two initiatives are things you could speak to at the moment, sir.
Well, I think that the first edition of Teaching in a Digital Age was written in 2015, and it's now in its third version, so I have updated it. But in fact, I wrote the section on skills in 2015, based primarily on a Royal Bank of Canada report called Humans Wanted, that was a survey, interestingly done via LinkedIn. What they did was do a big data search of job adverts through LinkedIn, job qualifications required, and came up with the immediate demand. But they also asked employers what they're looking for in 5 years' time as well. And that became very clear that a lot of these skills, if students pick them up, it's accidental rather than deliberate in terms of the teaching. So that hasn't changed at all since 2015. What I think the survey has shown is that digital learning and online learning is steadily increasing and pretty ubiquitous in Canadian universities. So that's a very good thing from my point of view, that at least students are getting exposed to at least some of the, you know, the digital literacy part to some extent. Although, again, it's sort of incidental. It's not taught as explicitly. They just have to learn how to log in and et cetera. But it's getting people used to working, to studying digitally so they can work digitally. Again, my concern is, if you think of a skill as a lifelong learning thing, like let's take something like independent learning, right? That's a skill that you want to have throughout life, and it will, probably you want to get better at it as you get older. The question for me is, how do you assess these skills? And in particularly, if you're an instructor, how do you move a student who comes into your class, probably from another class, with critical thinking skills, for instance, and how do you improve on that and measure that over the time that they're in your class? And what is the link you have with your previous, the instructor for the previous course on this, and the instructor who will take students on from your course after they move on to the next year or so? So, and we don't do that. We don't look at the curriculum in that way, not in terms of skills development. And I like to use the example of Djokovic, the tennis player. Now, he's 39 years old and he's still winning. And the reason he's winning is not because he's younger and faster than his opponents, but he's honed his skills. He keeps on honing. He's very smart. He knows exactly when to put the pressure on, when he's losing, etc., exactly how to do that. And you know, it's a lifelong learning skill. Now, eventually, his physique will run out, as it will for all athletes. But it's not just athletes we're talking about here. We're talking about, you know, people critically thinking in their jobs. And I'd like to think that I'm a better critical thinker now than I was when I graduated from university. But how did I get there? It was accidental. It wasn't taught in any way. Now, some of this is personal development, and that's another big thing. How much of this is the responsibility of the individual, and how much is it the responsibility of the instructor? Well, I think if you're teaching a subject like history, then critical thinking skills is really something that you should be very important to you, and you want to explicitly teach those skills to be a better critical thinker about what's happening in politics today as a result of your historical training and so on. And I would say the same for, it's even more important, I think, in the vocational area, that students have the skills of entrepreneurship, of leadership, for welders and for plumbers and so on, because often these are one person or two person businesses. They need all those other skills as well as the pure technical skills. So I'm not saying that the things that are taught in history or in welding aren't important. They are, but you've got to find a way to integrate the other skills into that teaching, because you can't teach them separately. It doesn't make any sense. Teaching a plumber to be a businessman in a bank doesn't make any sense. You want to teach a plumber how to run a business in plumbing, you know. And so they've got to be integrated. Now, you take the vocational area. What do? We hire experienced plumbers to teach plumbers. But we don't provide any real training for them to teach these other skills. And so again, it's the system that's the problem here. And I don't know how we shift the system into thinking differently about how we prepare our instructors for the 21st century.
That is an absolutely profound and thoughtful response in that way. I think what you're speaking to really lands, particularly for those of us who have spent time like in vocational and technical training institutes. Like for my career, the first 6.5 years really were spent teaching technical writing, very often, you know, paired with a subject matter expert in engineering technology or what the case may be. But I mean, that was very much sort of an improvised or ad hoc kind of effort. What I see you speaking to is sort of the need system-wide, perhaps, this may be because in this country, post-secondary is devolved onto provinces. There's very few national bodies or organizations that deal with education sector-wide, the CDLRA notwithstanding, and others, of course, you know, for instance, some of the excellent work that you and your colleagues have been doing at Contact North. I noticed, Tony, and I think Doug probably caught this too, on your website, you describe yourself as the very top of it, research associate with Contact North. So is that still something that you are consistently actively involved in? I've seen your blog posts. I've seen, you know, some pieces that kind of bubble up onto the site. I do wonder at this point in 2024, if this is something that you're still kind of into with both feet, so to speak.
Short answer is no. I went on my 85th birthday in April last year. I decided that I was going to retire as a consultant, right?
Okay.
I'm still associated with Contact North. I get the occasional phone call and said, can you do this? And I do that. But I'm really not looking for work now. And the reason for it is very simple. It's artificial intelligence. So at 85, I started thinking, here's ChatGPT. I've actually got ChatGPT on my website, if you notice.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I'm going to be a consultant, I'm really going to have to get on top of artificial intelligence and really understand how it works. And I have a bit of background in artificial intelligence already. I been working on and off with artificial intelligence in one form or another since early days of computer assisted learning in the 1980s. So I'm not a total novice, but to keep up with what's happening, and particularly machine learning, you really need advanced mathematics to understand how the algorithms are working. So I had a decision at 85. Do I need to go back to university or to college and take an advanced mathematics course, or should I spend that time playing golf? And it wasn't a difficult decision. So that's why I retired, and that's why I'm worried about this 50 to 65 year old group in universities and colleges who are saying, Jesus, you know, this is not what I signed up for. And that's because we haven't got a system that supports a shift of that magnitude within the system. And if they don't have at least a working understanding of artificial intelligence, then they can't apply it properly in their work. So, you know, you've got to have some level of expertise now if you're an instructor. And, you know, if you're a history teacher, suddenly you've got to worry about your students all doing their assignments by artificial intelligence, and you have to completely rethink how you're going to do your assessment. Yes. And without some training in alternative assessment methods and so on, I mean, I think it's a good thing. It will force assessment to a higher level. It will force them to assess students' critical thinking skills and so on rather than their memory. But how do you move a professor who's taught all his life in terms of content to move them into teaching these high level skills as well as the content, or integrate it with the content without it becoming a, you know, 120 hour a week workday.
Overloading educators who are notoriously short on time and resources, you know, even in the most optimal of eras, if I can say. And again, this is why I think, you know, resources such as teaching in a digital age are so helpful, because, you know, it draws primarily from actual data from these, you know, studies and inputs, and then sort of collates that. What really struck me about it is just how readable it is, how straightforward. It's not overly prescriptive. You can kind of just kind of jump into it and pull out certain aspects that, you know, are relevant to you, without, you know, feeling a deluge or a tsunami of educational content and jargon kind of coming over you. So, I mean, again, that was one of the things that when I became really aware of your work in this field, to me, that was just something that I really appreciated about it. And I think, you know, Doug, you've mentioned this work on your show, on our show before. I mean, when you were looking at the website, Doug, what's kind of jumping out with you in terms of, you know, what's on offer there?
One thing I really like is how we have had a theme of the student is what matters throughout our podcast over the last couple of years. And Tony, as I read your work, I see the same message there, because both my parents were teachers. And if they're not, if we're not here for the students, what are we doing? Right? Why do we have educational organizations? And I just wanted to jump back for a second. You talked about Singapore and their national strategy. And we have, like, Canada Skills for Success, and they've identified, like, the 9 key points. Let's do all these. But again, it's the same gap of how do we teach it? How do we assess it? How do we measure it? How do we do any of that? So the work has started, but this feels like going up Everest for the first time. Sir Edmund Hillary put that ladder down for the Hillary step. How do we get to the summit from where we are? Because there is a chasm between what's being measured and what's needed, and how is that happening?
I think there's, you know, the 3 levels of micro, meso, and macro that you have to look at here. At the micro level, it's the instructors, and that's why you have my book, Teaching in a Digital Age. It's something that the instructors can go to, and when they need it, and it's there online, it's on demand, it's free, they can access it at any time, and hopefully it's authoritative, and, you know, it's based on research and so on. So provide the resources, first of all. If I was a center for teaching and learning, I'd be putting up tons of online resources, not just my book, but maybe how to make a good video, you know, put that up. Yeah. 5, 10, 15 minutes that somebody can at least grasp how to do this, you know, very, very quickly, and then they can go further if they need. So on-demand resources for instructors, I think that's the micro level. The meso level, I think we have to look at the qualifications that are required to teach in a university now. And I think we, in particularly, it means looking at the postgraduate years and what's appropriate for people who want a career in university or even more so vocational training. And we need to build programs that are integrated, certainly with the PhD, so they're not only doing research, but they're also getting a background in teaching. And I know all the reasons why that's not going to happen, right? I can give you all the reasons. But that really, that's in a sense, it's a departmental or institutional requirement that we need to change the process of postgraduate education for people who are going to go on to become instructors and so on. And that would probably mean looking at trades training as well, so that there's a way to prepare instructors in trades training so that they have a broader view than just just focusing on the actual technical skills.
Yes.
So that's the meso level. The macro level, I think governments have really got to take this seriously. This is an economic development issue. It's not an educational issue. If we don't provide the skills that people will need to create new jobs, to move when their job changes to another job without too much of a problem, etc., then our economy is not going to grow. It's a productivity issue here. We talk about Canada's dismal productivity. Well, here's one reason why. We are not got a good lifelong learning system that's integrated with the workforce. You know, we're closing down, for God's sake, some of our continuing education departments when they couldn't be more needed than they are. Or we've got to get the mainline faculties to take lifelong learning a lot more seriously than they do. Now, yeah, we have a lot of talk about micro-credentials and so on. That's necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's nowhere near sufficient. We need to be much more fundamental in our thinking about this. So at the macro level, we need some leadership from government here and some incentives. And again, I'm not saying they need to put more money in the post-secondary system, although that would help, but they need to make sure that money that they are giving is being spent in a way that allows these 21st century skills to be embedded in all forms of teaching.
That is so rad, to use a term. radical is what that is, sir. Everything that you just described. I'll sort of wait to see if Doug wants to weigh in on any of that.
When you started talking about trades education, because I used to work at NAEP, and just the light bulb that went off on, why aren't we teaching mentorship there and more how to run a plumbing business, that sort of stuff. That just set off light bulbs that I'm going to run with, and we're probably going to, Matt, you and I are going to talk about this at another point.
Doug's the director of this initiative. He always is the person who kind of throws out the topics, and he's kind of generous with my, you know, allowing me a certain level of input as producer and possibly, you know, interviewer kind of guy. But when Doug sort of pulls out a topic, it's always like, you know, totally legit. So I'm going to take that to heart, Dr. Reed. Tony, we really want to be respectful of your time. We told you we'd try and keep this, you know, to 40 or so minutes. And especially, you know, given that you are well into your retirement, sir, a well-earned retirement, perhaps I'm going to cop one of Doug's questions at the end of the document here, even though you may have kind of answered this in a roundabout way. One of the questions Doug punched in here was, are you optimistic for the future of education and ed tech? I mean, despite all the qualifications you may have just described, I saw that question in the document. I was just like, okay, that might be kind of a good way to kind of start to transition out of the recording with, sir.
Well, if at one level I'm pessimistic because I see it as what they call a wicked problem in post-secondary education. Now, there are not easy solutions. There are solutions, but they're often ones that people are going to be very reluctant to take because it means huge changes. On the other hand, I'm optimistic in the sense that the technology continues to improve, continues to become more useful. And we have a huge resource amongst the people out there. We're dealing with intelligent people when we talk about instructors, either in the vocational or the university areas. These are smart people, and they will adapt to these changes faster. I think the change will happen faster at the micro level than it will at the macro level, although it should happen the other way around. It should be at the macro level where it starts. So my optimism is based on people and their flexibility and adaptability. And they will find solutions that I can't think of, for instance. That's why I'm optimistic.
Awesome. Sir, that is just absolutely fantastic. I'm going to ask Doug if you have anything else you want to kind of put towards Tony before we wind down our conversation today.
Other than a thank you for coming on and agreeing to chat with us, no, just thank you so much. I've loved your insight and what you've had to say and how you've said it, so thanks.
And can you send me a link to your podcast so I can listen to some?
Absolutely, sir. We are into, if you count the interview components, which are sort of separate from the primary, you know, normal format, we're into the 60s now anyway, in just over 2 years. Doug is a teacher from a family of teachers. Doug's grandparents were actually teachers. So he's just like, once a week, unless there's a reason not to. And 2 years later, you know, here we are. So again, I would just say, Tony, thank you a million and then some for just kind of, you know, we don't have any strong personal connections. I mean, we met at a conference or two back, you know, back in the day for me. Then, you know, just through LinkedIn, really just a cold sort of, dear Tony, would you be interested to speak to us? And I was absolutely chuffed. I was positively thrilled and chuffed when you responded positively and right away. So without a doubt, Tony, we'll be sure to send you a link to the site with all of the resources and podcast info.
Great. Thanks.
Sir, it has been an absolute privilege. I'm going to end the recording now. Take care, everybody. Bye for now.
Thanks.
Bye.